This is All Things Git, the podcast about Git. I'm Edward Thompson.
I'm Martin Woodward.
Hey, Martin. It's good to have you back.
Good to be back as ever. So who we got on the show today?
Today we have Joe Nash.
Oh, Joe. Okay, let me read Joe's bio. I'll do that one. Joe is the student program manager at GitHub, where he works to help student leaders build inclusive learning environments. Apart from that, we're not capitalizing the H in GitHub. Yes, it is all one word, camel cased. Joe can usually be found talking about the educational benefits of hackathons or rolling D20s. Joe, you're going to have to educate me there. What the heck's a D20? Is that some sort of hexagonal dice thing? What's that about?
That is exactly it, yes. It's a 20-sided die used in Dungeons & Dragons and other tabletop games.
Okay, there we go. My the only time I've ever played Dungeons and Dragons and tabletop games aren't as big of a thing. Would it be fair? I don't know if Ed, you live in the UK now.
I do.
I don't know if they're as big of a thing over here. Maybe they are, just not where I hung out.
I have no idea. They were big when I was in high school, at least along my peer group.
They're having I guess you could call it a bit of a comeback. There's been podcasts that have and video and shows on Twitch that have recently brought them back in vogue, and they're currently seeing a boom in popularity. I'm guess one of the new wave born from that generation.
You're saying we're old, is what you're saying, Joe?
Basically, yes. Good start there. Offend the hosts.
Always good. Yeah. So let's talk about capitalization while we're there. So obviously GitHub is all one word, capital G, capital H. But you do a lot of Git education, with people. Do you want to should we talk to the listeners a minute about Git and how that should be case, how that should be?
This is so important.
Exactly.
So that one I don't have terribly strong opinions on. The H comes up in my day-to-day a lot, working with students, especially working with student leaders. A lot of them are asking us for sponsorships to get involved. And the amount of emails, very well thought out, very well-meaning emails I get, which are like, hey, can you please support our group? Spelling our company name incorrectly became a bit of a hilarious point for me. But I don't know about Git. I hear Ed has the strong opinions on Git itself.
Oh, of course I do. But going back to GitHub real quick, I actually opened the biggest pull request on the Azure docs that I've ever opened was correcting every instance of GitHub to be properly cased. I was very proud of that.
You are fighting the good fight. Yeah,
I'm doing my best.
There's so many, it happens so frequently where I see a really fantastic API integration or GitHub app. And I'm just like, oh, this is wonderful. And then two lines into the documentation, I see the lowercase h. I'm just like, oh, how did you get all through the docs and not see that? I mean, obviously, no one really cares about following corporate brand guidelines. So that's totally fair, I guess.
Well, I care very deeply about it.
Tell me the answer to Git and Git, Ed. What is it?
Yeah. So
it's all uppercase, like Lua, right?
Yeah, that's right. It's an acronym. No, that one drives me crazy is the all caps GIT, because Git is not an acronym. It's capital GIT is how I think about the Git community, the ecosystem of tooling and repositories and all that. And then lowercase GIT is the Git command itself. That's, what you run on the command line. And all uppercase is something else. I don't know what that is.
It's an insult in English.
There you go. Right.
In the Queen's English.
That divide in particular is really interesting because I imagine that must help a lot when working, I guess, in the internal spaces of Git, working with the maintainers and contributors and co, in actually having that shared language to know what part of the tool and of the ecosystem you're talking about.
Yeah, I think it does. And the thing that makes me cringe is sometimes around Microsoft, people will talk about the tool as git.exe.
Oh, incredible.
Yeah, I know. Isn't it great? It's so weird. The first time I heard that, I was like, wow, that's strange. Who would do that? And then it caught on. And so you hear it quite a bit. It's
they use git.exe to mean Git for Windows, though, don't they? Rather than Git the community. You know what I mean?
Yeah, actually, I was going to. So that's an absolute magic thing to me. The Git bash for Git for Windows is just incredible.
We're going to have a disagreement very early on, Joe.
Oh, really?
Yeah, carry on going. I'll let you hoist your own petard first.
Oh, well, okay. I'm sure once you get sufficiently deep, it's awful. But for me, turning up to a workshop doing a bunch of students and there's some Windows PCs there and they're just instantly and at least an environment that works how I expect it to work. Oh, it's like mini Sigwin. It's beautiful. It's so good.
I think you two are saying the same thing, actually. or you're about to, but I'll let
I'm really excited for this.
Yeah, so basically Git bash prompt, in my opinion, is a non-native environment in Windows, and so we shouldn't be encouraging people to be using that non-native environment to go do Git commands in. Now I can see the point in, you know, it's great for doing training because you can turn up and you type ls and you don't get shouted at. But the PowerShell prompt in Windows, you can go there and type ls and you don't get shouted at as well. Or the bash on Windows and then using Git from there. Now the fascinating thing is if you use bash on Windows and use Git in there, then you're going to get into all sorts of hurt if you try to do interoperability.
Interesting. There is definitely the angle that I'm being a very lazy educator, yeah. But it is very handy.
No, I can see that. But yeah, it's. I just don't think, if you tell Windows people, go use Git bash, then you're going to turn off 90% of Windows developers because they think they have to use this Git bash thing. I know it was a huge challenge when we started introducing Git to the Windows team because they were like, what the hell is this? I want to use the command shell. And it wasn't the default option at the time to install Git on the path. And so anyway, go on, Ed.
No, I was just going to say, you know, you're saying that Windows users shouldn't be forced to learn bash because
it's not.
Because there's no point in learning bash just to use your version control tool.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? But Joe's similarly saying that he doesn't want to have to use CMD just because he's not familiar with it.
There you go. Well, this is the new Microsoft. There are choices, I guess. So I guess that's really
I guess the bit I would counter with there is, I guess, in particular, the students that like are coming into workshops in like their first year computer science for Windows laptops, they're probably not intentionally making the decision to be a Windows user at that point. Yeah. It is probably mostly like history and their computer usage to date. But once you've made that conscious decision, then yeah, absolutely, you should be in your native command environment.
Yeah,
I think so too. Have you heard of the Uncanny Valley?
I have. I love that as a concept and as a thing.
Right. Yeah. It's so if there are listeners out there who haven't, it's the idea that, you know, robots are cute and lovable. Like we kind of anthropomorphize them and they're great until they look too much like humans. And then all of a sudden they're terrifying to us. Like we see them and we're like, oh, that's terrifying. That's the way I think of Git bash. Mm-hmm. It's just Unix-y enough that it's terrifying to me.
That's such a great description of it. That's wonderful.
I like that. And the problem with saying like the bash shell on Windows is that you need such an up-to-date version of Windows and you're working with students who are turning up with, you know, 9-year-old secondhand laptops and things that are running Windows XP or something horrible.
For sure.
Yeah. And then, you know, or whatever. So at least with like a, you know, now you've got a lot of these cloud environments and cloud learning environments, you can actually just go to a website and type commands in there and it's all good.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, even like we're getting to a point with a lot of those like Glitch where version control is going to new and exciting places, but we don't necessarily have to deal with it in the same way to achieve the same ends. Like getting students to pull down a Git repo to just start the workshop is no longer necessarily the easiest way to get going with these cloud environments where they can just open a link and be direct in the right container, right environment, good to go.
Fascinatingly, I was teaching, well, not teaching, teaching would be the wrong word. My son, who's 13 now, wanted to learn how to code a website. And like he asked me this, and I was like, oh, yeah, whatever. So I kind of pointed at him at some resources and then went away and left him and thought he'd get bored and came back again. And he'd, you know, done a bootstrap site with a load of CSS customizations in and some animations. I'm like, oh, okay, he wants to learn how to build a website. And so I set him up with just, you know, a basic Git repo that he was pushing, that he was actually did it on GitHub and then have it pushing out to Azure. And he was just using the editor in GitHub and hitting save and he was done. And that he was fine with that as a dev environment.
That's awesome. Yeah, I spend a lot of time in the GitHub editor mainly because like a lot of the time I'm working with markdown files and like the way we do stuff internally at GitHub. And there's a lot of browser extensions now that make it actually really quite powerful and really fully featured, which is great to see. And I'm seeing increasingly people do that, especially like as Chromebooks have randomly come in vogue again as a developer tool. I've got a colleague who works entirely on Chromebooks. He's using Crouton, so he does go into full editors occasionally. But yeah, it's just amazing. That's the point we're at, that that is the easiest option for so many use cases.
So what sort of plugins are people using and what do they do? This is new to me.
One that I see all the time on Twitter is Octotree, which gives you basically like the full project explorer that you probably used to seeing in the side of Visual Studio Code or Atom or whatever. Up there next to whenever you go and view a file in GitHub and you look at the code, you get it on the side. And when you're editing as well, I think it's there on the side. I actually haven't used it yet, but I've seen it all over my Twitter in the last like 2 weeks. So that one's really interesting. And there's what's it called? It's not improved GitHub or better. I think it's better GitHub or something, which is literally just like a full conversion suite. It's just someone who is essentially turning their wish list for GitHub features into a Chrome extension. And it has a lot of stuff in there. And that does some really cool stuff as well.
I found it fascinating that the Gmail are coming out with a new version of Gmail, and this is big news. And one of their things that they're working on is ensuring that browser plugin developers have had chance to play with the new version of Gmail so that they can update their browser plugins for Gmail. And I'm like, I'm not using any. Now I've got FOMO, but I'm not using any plugins for Gmail. What am I missing out on?
Right. I don't know if I have any that work on Gmail, actually. I used to have, what is it called? That one that did the really insidious thing where it would work out someone's social profiles from their email and then give you loads of information about them in the sidebar while you're emailing them.
Terrifying.
Yeah, it got bought by LinkedIn and now it's like $100 a month.
Well, we can get it for free. Yeah. We'll get you the staff discount.
I was going to say bad things about it and then I realized that now they're coworkers.
Yeah, I thought I'd get in there and help you early.
Cool. And now, so I've done a couple of things where I've gone to I live in Belfast and I've like gone along to Queen's University and sort of done a brown bag with the first year students on, hey, here's how to do here's Git version control, you know. And again, me and Ed are so old, as we've already established in this podcast, that we remember when there are other version control systems to Git. And now mostly it's, hey, here's Git. You know, you don't bother telling them about version control as a generic concept. So when you go in, where do you find people are at in terms of what they know about version control? And then what's the first sort of things you do to introduce them to why version control is important to them?
Sure. And actually, I guess a good place to start is on the age thing. So I think one thing that we found very surprising was actually the extent to which older version control systems are still very widely taught. So SVN is still incredibly common. They're still seeing a lot of SVN. And a lot of that is due to just like, I guess, simplicity of collaboration model, but centralized.
Don't underestimate, how much effort lecturers don't want to go to update their courses as well.
For sure, yeah. And we have my colleague who works with teachers, Mozzadrella, she has a great theory about, or I guess it's more of a, less of a theory and more proved at this point, but a great thing she recognizes about teachers and their teaching of Git, which is one of the things that limits teachers moving to newer tools, isn't necessarily the effort to update their slides. It's the fear of being wrong in front of students. And I think we've all had that like experience of Git where like you get into, you're following your usual commands and something goes a little bit wry and then you're in the bad place and you're like, oh God, how do I get out of this? And it's very much that is very at the forefront of teachers' minds when they're thinking about moving on to something like Git, because they don't want that to happen in the classroom. So when we approach a new class students, usually they either be in a case where they've seen some limited older form of version control, or they have never done any form of collaboration at all in any kind of shape or form. And up to this point, maybe they've passed some stuff around with emails or Dropbox. So usually where I start is actually just explaining collaboration and why that's different with code. I like to give the comparison of how we would work on a piece of prose where, hey, like you send me a beautiful poem that you've written and you want me to edit it. So you send me it via, I don't know, Google Docs or email or something like that. And I just edit it directly and that's fine because at the end of the day, it's just text. And the worst thing I can do is ruin its artistic integrity. But when you send me a piece of code and I change it, suddenly that's traffic lights that don't work. It's a computer doesn't start up. It's a plane doesn't take off because code, unlike the other forms of text we're used to working with, actually becomes something and it compiles and it becomes something that needs to work. So when we collaborate on that model, we need a lot more information about the changes that are being made, who's making them, why they're making them. And most importantly, we need to be able to undo those changes if something goes wrong. And I think that's usually the baseline that I kind of set. And actually, I had a conversation with someone the other day about GitHub's, like, I guess GitHub's part in getting new users actually being the, like, trying to convince people that software collaboration is an important thing. And the way we currently do that through this really protracted cycle of like convincing people open source is a good thing, where it's like we do a lot of outreach and marketing around open source, and when we go out to new developers, we go for this really long protracted journey of teaching them that open source is great, when actually what we should be saying to them is like collaboration is great. Here, let's go straight to version control. Yeah, kind of an off tangent there. But yeah, so that's usually where I start, just for teaching collaboration. And then from there, I find it's pretty easy to get straight into concepts. I have had a lot of discussions about the best way to get into the tooling. I prefer to start with GitHub because then you get through terminology like commits, branches, pull requests, that kind of thing, in a safe environment. You're not confronting them all with like, oh, I'm seeing Git for the first time, I'm seeing version control for the first time, and I'm seeing a shell for the first time. This is all a lot of stuff. So I like to start in the browser, do the concepts, and then bring them down to the command line.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a great idea.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. About so you can even like teach that. People how to do their first pull request with never having to touch a console, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And we have a free online training course. It's called on-demand training, and it's actually run by a bot, so students get, there's like a website that walks them through like what they're doing. They get dropped into a repo, the bot adds them as a collaborator, and then they make their first pull request to a file, and then the CI will check it, make sure it's all okay, and then they can merge it. And I usually use that as the base of my workshops because, I mean, A, it's like a really nice exercise, but they can then go back and pick up any steps they might have missed or not feeling sure on later. But then, yeah, like through the course of that, they go into GitHub, they make their own branch. Well, first of all, they get added as a collaborator, then they make their own branch, they edit a file right there in the editor, they make a commit, then they do a pull request, they see status checks right there. It does everything. And then after that, like they've seen a little bit of like all of the concepts of, I guess, working in a modern collaborative setting on software. And then you can start to really ramp up with like, okay, cool. So that status check thing, that was CI. Let's go see Travis. Cool. So you've learned about branching. Let's go see Git and do something a bit more complicated. And it's a really great.
Now, when you're doing students and student projects, obviously the thing that they like actually collaborating is incredibly painful for them because that's usually when people mess up your marks. And, you know, doing the student project part is always the most stressful thing because you've got to rely on Billy Bob, who's really like a flake and doesn't do his thing. And, you know, and or you are Billy Bob and you think, woohoo, sure. I'm going to get everybody to do my work, you know. So how are you going about teaching them collaboration? Because that's, you know, you're now crossing the line here between dev skills and interpersonal skills.
Yeah, and I think that's definitely the area I'm, I guess, more comfortable in at this point in my career. So that first one's an interesting one, that whole like concept that universities use group projects as kind of the setting of an awful social experiment.
Never a good experience either, is it? You know what I mean? You go into work hating, like fearing group interactions.
Yeah. And that's like, that's very intentional on the part of, I mean, from what I've always got from lecturers, that's like very intentional for them. But they want you to feel, they almost want to put students through the worst possible group experience they can have as a lesson in conflict management and like working. And I guess it's
what
this isn't that's as common insane. This isn't as common in the US. We're definitely speaking from a very UK perspective here, but there's definitely a like almost stiff upper lip approach to it, where they were like, you will encounter incompetence in the industry. You will have to get used to it.
Come on, chaps. Over the edge.
Yeah.
This is blowing my mind.
Exactly. Like, I've spoken to lecturers who have directly said, like, yeah, when we make group assignments, we make sure that there are two 1 and above students. There is a couple of two to low two one students. And then we make sure there's like at least one failing student who doesn't show up for lectures. Like, they actively try and make that melting pot. There's some parts where when I go and do like a GitHub demo, I show the insights tab, which is the tab where you can see the graphs of, for example, who's been committing, when they're committing, who's the highest contributor. And when I do that, you see in the students in the lecture theater, like, alternations between absolute jubilation as they realize that they can justify them having the higher marks, and then expressions of fear from the people who are like, oh no, it's going to reveal me in the group project. If I slip up, everyone's going to know. And I think that is an interesting potential moment for a lot of students when they realize that, like, hey, there's this industrial tool where everyone on the team can instantly see at a glance that, like, I might not be doing as much work as other people. And that's definitely very much a either anxiety-inducing make or break moment for a lot of people. When it comes to actually, like, getting people over that hump of, like, I'm going to be contributing to a group project and working in the public and working in the open is very scary. And that's definitely something we see a lot with open source and getting people into open source. The way I like to approach it is definitely very much speaking about the benefit of having your work be publicly documented in this way, like having your work be visible. There's a couple of student profiles that I like to show. So obviously the GitHub profile, you've got a couple of neat things on this one. Someone's GitHub profile, you've got like their pinned repositories, you've got the contribution graph, which is, again, its own kind of anxiety-inducing thing for some people. So it's not always a positive thing. And then there's the feed. But one thing I like to show students is like, hey, here's, for example, there's a student in India called Shapeksha, which is now working at Microsoft, actually. And she did Outreachy when she was a student. And so one of her pinned repositories is a Mozilla repository, and it shows up in her feed that she contributed to those Mozilla projects. And now she's an engineer at Microsoft, which is...
no coincidence, yep.
Yeah, exactly. And there's another student, Peter Dave Hello, who's in Taiwan, who... he runs CDN.js, so his GitHub profile is just all kinds of, it's just the purest green, because it's just constantly, right. Yeah, like he's running a package manager on GitHub, and it's just intense. And again, he's had loads of fantastic opportunities. So I try to use these like live examples. I then also do make sure that they get the counter examples. So the counter example is usually, unfortunately, my profile. My profile up until I joined GitHub was pretty abysmal. There was a pretty consistent patch of green in 2014, where there's a 2-week period where my profile is solid green. And if you go and look at what those squares are, it's actually my third year final project, where apparently I did it in 2 weeks instead of the year it was meant to take. And aside from that, my GitHub profile is just misery, and it actually shows you that I have poor time management, and GitHub still hired me, so it's not all bad. So I guess like these examples are, I think, the best on-road in collaboration, kind of show them role models, show them what they could be working on, who they could be working with, how doing something as simple as like working on a project that you love in your free time can get you massive opportunities. And that tends to get them pretty excited to get the first go, and then they go out into an open source project and they encounter someone who steps up and really helps them out. Like, if you get them into the right project to begin with, and they get, I guess, mentored, and they have that wonderful first open source experience, then they're gonna get a really positive first experience of collaboration.
So I think it's great that you're pushing them towards open source and towards collaboration. I'm a little bit curious how you feel about using open source as a metric, really, for analyzing people's skills, or for maybe even making hiring decisions. Because, you know, it's great if you can contribute to open source, because it's very easy to look at the code that you've written then and evaluate you. But not everybody has the time to do that, or the opportunity to spend time working on open source in their free time. Not everybody has free time to use. So
for sure, yes, I am very broadly speaking pretty So I see it as something that it's more of a networking opportunity than something that's like a CV, for example. And I think most GitHubers are pretty staunchly against, for example, companies using GitHub as part of like the evaluation process. We don't do that internally, and we don't encourage anyone to do that. Certainly the contribution graph, like as I gave my own example, my contribution graph is basically empty before I joined GitHub and had to start using it every day. Although I'd worked in like software for the last couple of years, that was in, like, for example, I worked at PayPal in the financial sector, where any code I did write was not publicly visible on my GitHub profile, right? So that's definitely something that I think can be a double-edged sword. I can see why companies and why hirers are tempted by GitHub profiles, but I think it's far more useful. Like the space open source occupies for a student trying to get employed, in my mindset, is if you are one of those students who does have get ample free time during their degree, because you're fortunate enough to get a student loan or don't have to work or whatever reason, it is a great way to meet other people who are interested in the same space as you are. But it's definitely by no means, I would say, something that's compulsory for success in the industry. I think there's a lot of other ways of achieving the same ends. And universities increasingly give those opportunities. So a great example is my former university, University of Nottingham. They actually have now a credit giving module in the third year where you can get 10 credits for contributing to an open source project. So 10 credits is a 12th of a year. So it's a full module, same as doing an algorithms class. And if you go contribute to an open source project and you write up a report on it, you get academic credits to it. So you get to use your university time to actually go and do that. And that's something that's increasingly common in a lot of UK universities. So I think I would say there are people who are hearing a lot about what open source can do for them, but they are worried about like the time aspects. And you are still in education. I would definitely look at where projects in line of your degree can help you out with that.
Wow, that's incredibly cool.
It is, because I'm always sucked at doing exams, but I was good at I didn't mind putting the work in, and I would have been hacking around that stuff anyway. So I'd go for courses that move towards that sort of thing. I was talking to a cool student the other day who runs a project called pynet.org. I'm going to do a quick shout out to him.
I thought you would be. When you said Queens. Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, because that's just amazing. And and it's a great project for doing Raspberry Pi work in the classroom. And it does, you know, network booting Raspberry Pis and then having them all running off one image and things. So, and he's great. And he maintains his project as a student. I don't know how he does that at all.
Yeah. And he also builds a huge community.
Yeah.
So I guess you're talking about Andrew Mulholland.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So Andrew also runs regular Pi Jams, yep. Really regular Pi Jams in Belfast. And he's also kind of like holds the Pi Jam network in the UK together in a lot of ways. He runs the Youth Zone at Mozilla, MozFest every year. Right. And does these, like, he gets like all these young, like, we're looking like kids between like the age of like 13 and 15, and he brings them all to MozFest every year, works with their parents to make sure they all get scholarships they can afford to get to London, and then help mentors them through like delivering their own coding workshops, their own Git workshops, their own laser cutting workshops, like all kind of stuff. And yeah, it's just like, there's a section of MozFest that's just these fantastic kids, all supported by people like Andrew and the work he does. It's really fantastic.
Amazing. Yeah, let's just hope everybody's first experience to open source is through somebody amazing like Andrew or yourself, you know, and it's not through some Reddit troll or something. I hope it's
some mailing list where people are yelling at
you. Yeah, well, you know, there's plenty of that going on, but yeah.
Yeah, speaking of collaboration and Git, there's a tweet that I saw the other day, which I thought was absolutely incredible in terms of describing the problems with teaching Git. And I'm trying to find it because I think...
Was this the one from David Newbury?
Yes, it was. Yes. Yeah. Which was, Git reminds me of some academic concepts. You can teach it, but it only really makes sense if you know the history of what came before and have worked at a level of complexity where you need it. Once you get it, it changes your worldview, but explaining why that's so is so hard. And that's just was an incredible summary to me. And I think it's really interesting how, like, you two started asking about teaching Git and collaboration in universities in, like, from your perspective of having seen what came before, and definitely the amount of students who miss that. I just found that, like, that hits true for so many. Like, when you ask how I teach collaboration, like, for so many students, it's not at all clear why something as heavy duty as Git is necessary, and why it's, like, even at their stage, why it's better than Dropbox.
Yeah, they're happy
because they
Dropbox.
Just haven't been through, like, mm-hmm. Yeah, like, until you've worked on like a project of like 50 contributors like 50 engineers, and you've had to manage people working at a level of complexity. It's just completely, seems completely absurd.
Yeah.
So I both agree and disagree with this tweet. I guess it depends on what he means by the history of what came before, because if you're talking about no collaboration or file shares and Dropbox, then yes, I totally understand explaining why these things don't work or why they don't scale, why they don't fit into production. But the other way you could read this is to talk about Subversion and why Subversion is quote unquote bad or Clearcase or whatever. And that I hope that we're not putting that into kids' heads. I hope we're not going to, or anybody's head, anybody getting started with software development. I hope that we're not like going to compare and contrast, centralized version control versus distributed version control. And so it's good to hear you say that, because that was the way I read this tweet when I saw it. And so I guess I hadn't really thought about it from your perspective.
Right. Yeah, I definitely think there is definitely some tooling aspect to it. For me, it was much more about workflow. We're just like working, the problems that arise from working on software at that scale are just, you cannot anticipate them when you're just learning to code, let alone like maybe worked with one other person on a project in your life. And I think it's very hard to take someone at that point in their career and be like, hey, so we're going to add like an additional heap of complexity to just writing a single line of code and getting that into a code base. Trust me, it'll be good for you.
Yeah, right. You have to give them the check. You have to give them the carrot, you know, look, by doing this, we now have code reviews via pull request, and we can, you know, we now have CI/CD set, you know, because you've got a CI/CD pipeline set up, we now have builds done and all this sort of thing. And it's just all automated for you. And then it becomes a lot more sense why I would bother using this crazy command line tool that's just archaic and makes no sense.
Yeah, I think the CI/CD workflow is like, that's the one that really hits home to me, because I didn't have that when I started, of course. And so like having green lights that tell me, yeah, this is probably a good change would have been revolutionary, instead of like me checking in garbage and it being bad in production.
But the number of times when you're working on projects as well as a kid, and I just like, I had something that worked and was actually decent, and then I went down a rabbit hole, and now I'm very, very broke, and I just wish I could, you know, it's going to take me 2 days to get back to where I was before. So I think maybe you need to have done that like once or twice and learned the pain to know how handy it was to be able to just roll back.
Sure. Like the first time I truly understood the reflog and how to use it was just like hallelujah moment. And the same with CI/CD.
I'm still not at that. Yeah.
Same with CI/CD as well. Like I think, again, I distinctly remember like the first time realizing that status check on GitHub that was doing all the really cool stuff. Wait a minute, I can actually just stick whatever bash script I want behind that and it will check whatever I want. Oh my God. It was just revolutionary to me. Yeah. It was very cool.
But you do worry about people whose first exposure to code, you know, like coding through some open source project, especially if it's a big one, because I remember like how long I lurked on like the Apache mailing list for, you know, months and months and months, and like before I dared submit my first, it would have been a patch back then, you know, my first patch over to Apache or one of these open source projects, you know, like Eclipse or something that was involved in the early days. You know, there's a lot of, for every person that contributes, there's got to be like at least 100 sat there lurking with massive imposter syndrome.
For sure. Yeah, I think it's a really interesting, like what Ed asked earlier about kind of using open source as a both metric success, but also like as a onboarder for people in education. I think it's definitely a controversial thing because a lot of contributors are already doing work for a lot of like maintainers are already doing work for free and stress stuff as it is. And although all of them in their heart of hearts probably deeply care about the success of students and want to mentor them, adding that to their workload is definitely difficult. I think there's this really interesting space of like educating by open source, where most people come to open source projects either because they want something, it doesn't do what they want and they want it fixed, or because they want to get some code in there and become a contributor for like reasons external to that project. So like they're a student and they've been told that's a good thing to do. And I guess that's that kind of situation where we're sending, like people either coming to their project already angry at the maintainer, or they're coming to the project to do something that isn't necessarily aligned to the maintainer's goals. I think it's something that needs to be filled that's a vacuum that needs to be filled in the education space. So one of the things we've been trying, so we run this training program for community leaders called Campus Experts, where basically the idea is like, hey, if you're a student on campus and you want to help your peers learn things that aren't covered in lectures, like Node.js and that kind of thing, we'll train you to do it. But the way we run that project is through a Git repo. So all these students are in this Git repo submitting non-code exercises, their essays, their that kind of thing. Through the GitHub flow, they're making branches, they're adding their file, they're doing a pull request, and then we're reviewing their essays the same way we'd review code. But this is like a 500, 600 person repo. So at the same time, they're also seeing all of the pain points of working on a massive code base with loads of other people. And quite a lot of the time, they're running into some hairy Git situations. We had to teach a bunch of them how to revert recently because they kept doing multiple assignments in one pull request. And that, I think, kind of accidentally got to a more interesting model where like we have a completely superfluous project. Like it's not someone else's open source project that someone's trying to maintain because like actual software is using it. It's something that's completely abstract from software. But to do that and to take part in the program, which is, I guess, the carrot you were talking about leading, they're having to follow the same workflow they'd have to follow an open source project. And I think that could potentially be healthier for everyone, both the students, because you're not having to do this like anxiety-inducing lurking before you're confident enough to go contribute, because it's an environment intentionally made for you to go and do that. And then also we're taking that group of people off the maintainers' plates and not making their lives more difficult with having like to like, because as a maintainer, when you come to a student's pull request or like a beginner's pull request, you really want to do a great job with like helping them. But at the same time, you're trying to keep this project going. So I think that's...
Yeah, you kind of just want to say to them, hey, can you squash that into and then give me this and give me that? And, you know, and you're like, no, I obviously don't know how to do that, but I want to encourage you to be a valuable contributor.
Exactly, yeah. So I think there's a space for like projects that obviously that like can still be useful and still be important, but that are made primarily for this group of people, like people getting into the industry. And the first priority isn't maintaining enterprise software or like making sure this software is usable, but actually isn't giving people a good onboarding experience. And I guess projects like Hoodie are a good example of that, where Hoodie isn't itself like a great project and is super, super awesome, but Hoodie was made to be like a friendly web framework. So at the same time, they've gone and made the project itself super easy to contribute to, and they've got bots that welcome newcomers, and they've got a whole infrastructure around super beginner friendly issues and that kind of thing. And that's kind of the focus of the project more than the health of the framework.
Very cool. We had one thing that's running right now. We were having a discussion with some people internally, this is in our day job, about trying to encourage non-technical users to follow a pull request markdown type workflow.
Excellent.
Have you had any success in this? In like teaching them, no, it's not as scary as you think?
Yeah, actually. So I tend to do a lot of workshops with like all kinds of groups. And there's one in Manchester in particular that I do almost regularly now, which is to not non-technical, but non-CS students. So they're designers. And yeah, I think the same things apply. I think this is almost definitely more a GitHub than Git thing. I think you definitely need a super friendly GUI to make it very applicable to those people. But I guess the message that I try to convey in those situations is like, no matter what role in the company you're doing, every company is going to be having tech somewhere now. You're going to be having software somewhere now. Whether you're a product manager, whether you're a designer, whether you're a writer, you will want to input into the products that are being created via software. You're going to want to have some insight into those. And the place that developers work and the way that developers work is through these workflows, through these tools. And if you are able to use those tools, and actually they're not as complicated as you think they are, you will have a much better time working with those people. You'll be able to get what you want much better. So pull request reviews are a prime example, right? Like pull request reviews are no more complicated than a Facebook comment. They're super, super simple interface on almost all the platforms that have them. You can click directly online you want to comment on and leave a comment. And even like getting that into your workflow and just having the GitHub account or having the whichever account it is to be able to go and see those and interact with those will make such a difference to anyone going into the industry. And then I think that functions as the ideal on-ramp. Because once you're in there, reviewing someone else's work, it then becomes a lot easier for you to say, well, okay, I'll open an issue and describe my own work. And I think the way GitHub does it internally is really interesting. I'm sure you folks have probably mentioned this before, but GitHub internally, like, we all use issues for everything, including the non-technical people. Every department communicates via issues. And that's initially just like kind of like a, I guess you can look at it as like a function dependent ticketing systems, where like if I want something from this department, I go to their repo and open an issue rather than having to find who to email. But then that works as a really great on-ramp, because they'll start with like an issue like, oh hey, like here's some work artifact, and someone will say, oh, this should be more permanent, can you make it into a document? So then they'll create a document, add it to the repo, and then they'll do that via a pull request, so people will comment on it and they'll review it, and then they'll go through the GitHub flow that a software developer would without necessarily realizing that they're doing that and it being introduced to them in those terms. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And I think GitHub is perhaps uniquely designed for that, whereas Microsoft maybe struggles a little bit more with those sorts of workflows because, you know, you want to use GitHub to build GitHub, which totally makes sense. But at Microsoft, we have so many technologies, right? You could also use Word for those documents instead of Markdown. So, so yeah, finding that balance has been a bit tougher for us.
Yeah, and this whole SharePoint thing's fascinating, you know, because us coming from the DevTools side, well, of course you want to do a pull request and edit a Markdown file, like, duh, why not? And then you've got the people who are over in SharePoint Office World, you know, it's fascinating.
It is.
Yeah, I've never had to use SharePoint to any great extent.
So it's now, the modern SharePoint's a lot like Google Docs in terms of, you know, your online collaboration.
Okay, great.
And all that sort of stuff. And you can see when somebody's editing it in real time. And then you have like the really rich UI where you can leave comments and things. So all the same like functionalities there that you would have. But what isn't there is the publishing backend. There isn't the ability to be able to stick a CI/CD on the back of it and have your output go directly to the publishing pipeline and be published. It's still a manual process to go publish that thing.
Right. And I guess also, so the thing that I guess really sold me on like putting my normal documents in GitHub versus like Google Docs was actually discoverability. I've had like past roles at companies that are heavily like Google Apps consumers and like have almost felt that my part of my role is Google Docs archaeologist, where like you're searching just desperately. Like you're writing a document, you're like, this must have been written before. And then you find it's been written like 6 times over 5 years, but it's just been lost in the drive somewhere and no one has been able to find it. And I guess SharePoint probably doesn't suffer that. So it's much harder to justify
it. Yeah, no, there is some search capabilities in there and blah, blah, blah. So, you know, it's a tricky one to win, unfortunately, but we'll get there eventually, Ed.
Cool.
So we should probably wrap up.
So thanks, Joe. I think this has been wonderful. It's great to learn how people coming into the industry are starting to learn how to use the tools. That's not something that I get to see every day. So thank you for sharing that with me.
Nice. Thank you so much for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
And thanks also for helping educate all these students on how to use version control and how to contribute to open source projects. Because as maintainers of open source projects, you know, we need fresh blood coming in all the time. And it's of huge value to the whole community. So thanks very much for all that work.
Not a problem. We try and work with as many teachers as possible to help them create those students. And the teachers we work with are truly wonderful at that.
Yeah. Cool. Well, yeah. Thanks, Martin, for coming in and being a co-host, and thanks, Joe, for joining us, and thank you for listening. If you have comments or ideas for future episodes, be sure to hit us up. We're on Twitter and we're on Facebook at All Things Git.